Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the moment Lyndon Johnson took the oath of office aboard Air Force One on November 22, 1963, he felt the clock ticking. With no guarantee he'd win the office for himself the following November, Johnson knew he might have just 11 months to push any truly important legislation through Congress. He set his sights on the Civil Rights Act, which did not go far enough for African Americans still being denied their right to vote, and went way too far for Johnson's Democratic Party to maintain its long hold on the American South. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The play All the Way, which won the 2014 Tony Award for Best Play, chronicles that tumultuous first year from Johnson's perspective and that of the Reverend Martin Luther King, who saw in the new president an imperfect ally, one committed to the Civil Rights Act, but also willing to deal away key aspects of civil rights legislation. Kevin Moriarty is artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center and director of its production of All the Way. Actor Brandon Potter plays LBJ in the play. It's running now at Dallas's Wiley Theater and has extended performances through April 3rd. Guys, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Johnson is pragmatic enough, despite his ego, to understand that he might only have a year in the White House. And with the sad benefit of hindsight, we know that King was in the final years of his life. Can you talk a little bit, Kevin, about how the ticking clock really drives the action here?
Sure. On November 22nd, 1963, here in Dallas, Texas, when the President Kennedy was assassinated, that set off this amazing year of change that no one could have foreseen on November 21st. Johnson was acutely aware that he was an accidental president, that no Southerner had been elected president since the Civil War, that he had an obligation to step into these shoes of responsibility as the leader, but also an opportunity to take the moment of this horrific tragedy and turn it into a moment of great change. Lyndon Johnson had spent his entire life trying to get power. He had made compromise after compromise in his life to amass and build and grow power. And then suddenly, with one gunshot, he was the most powerful man in the world. And aware that he had an election in 11 months where he would either be reelected, he would be elected president in his own right, or that opportunity would be gone forever. He seized that opportunity and did absolutely everything he could to cement his position as president and become reelected and to change the country forever in terms of civil rights.
Brandon, how did you work through Johnson's relationship to power? The line that you have where he talks about the fact that everyone wants power and those who say they don't want it are lying. I don't think that's true for everyone, but Johnson clearly believed it was.
Power is at the center of his universe, so he does think that everyone wants power. And more specifically, I think he thinks that everyone wants his power. I think that's how he was able to drive forward in his life, was playing the game with everyone. He didn't think that anyone wasn't playing the game. So that's how he was able to take all of the steps necessary to constantly be amassing power. And he did it in a variety of ways. There's all these stories about Johnson constantly going to, like, congressman's family functions and things like that. Like, he would fly across the country and show up at someone's dear aunt's funeral, you know, just so that he could show face and meet this person and say, I was here for you, you know. I don't think that everyone wants power. Brandon doesn't, but Lyndon does. And it's fortunate that he did think that way, because when he became this accidental president, he had been dealing with and obsessed with power for so long that I think he was probably the only person qualified to do that in that moment, in those circumstances, not only with becoming an accidental president, but at the pivotal point that we were in American history in terms of civil rights and the government's relationship to the people and all of that stuff.
Compared to the presidents who came after him, he was still acting very much like a legislator from the White House.
Mm-hmm. Because he spent a long time doing that. I mean, he was Senate president for so long, and he'd been in the game for a really, really long time. And he learned so much from FDR, right, who also acted like a legislator and also did that sort of stuff.
Well, not just compared to more recent presidents, but even compared to Kennedy. I mean, Kennedy had been given speech after speech, beautiful, beautiful rhetoric about civil rights and about many other aspects of his agenda, but very, very little of Kennedy's domestic agenda, not even the tax cut, had passed during Kennedy's lifetime. In 3 years in office, he had achieved very little because he wasn't able, he wasn't interested or able to make the rough and tumble, get into the mud kind of compromise choices.
He didn't care for that.
Exactly. He was much better at thinking and giving speeches and even in international relations, I suppose we could unilaterally use power, something a president can do as compared to domestic legislation, we have to work with Congress. Johnson was a man of the Senate and a man of legislating. Johnson was absolutely – Johnson knew that to make change in a democracy, you were going to have to get into the arena. You're going to have to roll up your sleeves and get bloody, get dirty, and actually make push people, threaten people, cajole people, beg people, plead with them, flatter them, do anything that it takes, and then make compromises that would make your base, your supporters, disappointed in you in order to make change happen. That's something that in our current political environment, whether you're on the right or the left in politics, is frowned upon by the electorate. I mean, I think today a lot of our voters think that if you elect a leader and they say, this is the thing I believe in, I'm going to do this, and then they achieve half of it, the base of that leader says, oh, well, you've compromised, which is a horribly bad thing, and you're a failure, that it's better in many voters' minds, in the majority of our voters' minds, I think in both parties, it's better to hold on to your pure belief and accomplish nothing, in which case you can blame it on the enemy on the other side, than it is to actually get into the political arena and step by step forge out a compromise that advances your agenda but doesn't achieve all of it. Johnson was the exact opposite, and so was King. King and Johnson as pragmatic leaders actually repeatedly gave up getting all of their vision in order to get some of their vision. And in doing that, the two of them together in the course of just a couple of years advanced American civil rights and many other domestic policies to a greater extent than almost any other president in the second half of the 20th century.
I was struck with both characters. I had a sense of the profound loneliness of being in their positions because although they have lots of people who want to be close to them and who want things from them and want to do things for them, because of those compromises, there are going to be times when they have to really, garner support for something that they don't entirely believe in and let go of their disappointments.
Yeah. I think that at the center of Johnson, aside from this need for power, is also a need for love. But the problem is that his lifelong quest for power, I think, alienated him from everyone around him, so that the people around him become either tools or obstacles instead of a place where you can get love, right? I think the closest to that is, of course, Lady Bird, his wife. But even then, she becomes sort of a whipping post sometimes. I know that's a cruel way to put it, but or a channel for his emotions instead of a way to really fully experience love. So everyone else in his life who he could potentially get love from, some of his closest aides and things like that, he has to forego that in order to make them useful for his agenda for the nation as a whole instead of to satisfy that deep personal need in himself. And I suspect that that King is the same way. You know, I mean, obviously not to the degree of Johnson. I think probably had a little bit more of an expansive heart and love, you know, as we all know, Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King. But I think that power kept him from everyone. The desire for power kept him from everyone. The desire to do good and get love from everyone ultimately keeps him from being close with anyone.
If you think about it, for a leader to be effective, they have to make difficult compromises. And that means alienating the folks around you who are true believers. So in the case of King, he's got Roy Wilkins and the old guard of the NAACP who are strongly advocating don't make waves, go along with, you know, work with the president and the establishment because by aligning ourselves with political power, largely white power, we'll be able to advance. Then he's got, on the other side, he's got Stokely Carmichael and Bob Moses and David Dennis who are advocating for a much, much more radicalized, aggressive approach. King ultimately has to make choices that alienate both of those groups. And we watch throughout his life and even in the context of the play as both the sides, King's, you know, right and left, become disappointed or frustrated with him or even break away. But again, what's funny about that is you think – not funny, maybe it's even sad – is that for in the moment living through that is the individual, the leader, experiences loneliness and even a sense of failure after failure. But from the perspective of history, we look back and we think Martin Luther King changed the world. It just doesn't look like that on the ground as it's happening. And that's something that not only comes to vivid life comically and dramatically and theatrically on stage, but it's something that really makes – at least makes me think a lot about the modern political world in which we live. What is the quality that we want from our leaders? That kind of purity or that kind of willingness to mix things up in a democracy and get stuff done?
We don't give them a lot of opportunities to exist off the record anymore, off stage.
It's incredibly striking. The things that Johnson does in the play are all rooted in the historical record. We know this because, for instance, all of the phone calls that Johnson made from the White House were recorded, and you can listen to them today. They exist at the LBJ Library. You can find them online. And it's absolutely fascinating to hear Johnson using the tools of power at his disposal in real time with McNamara and with King and with Humphrey and with all these other great historic leaders. But when you look at some of the tools he's using, they're tools we wouldn't accept a modern president using. First of all, we would find out about it. And second of all, instantly we would do everything we could to stop it. I mean, Johnson has J. Edgar Hoover's FBI at his disposal, and the FBI is spying on Martin Luther King. They're recording his sexual liaisons. They're spying on his associates that he's working with. And that information is being filtered from Hoover to LBJ. And similarly, you know, it's in a – now we don't have even earmarks on our bills in Congress. But back then, when Johnson's trying to get the Civil Rights Bill passed, he can call up a senator and say, OK, what you want is water. That's what you need in your state. And what I need is civil rights. And you're not going to get any water for your state unless you vote yes on this bill. And then miraculously a pool of money is going to be allocated over to your state to address this critical need you have. And sometimes that crosses ethical boundaries. Sometimes that means LBJ saying to a Southern congressman, I know you have a plantation. I know that plantation relies on crop support that comes from the United States government. I can turn that crop support off, which will affect your livelihood unless you're willing to vote the way I need you to vote. Those are tools that our modern presidents, for the most part, we would not want them to have in the post-Watergate, more modern good government era. But you lose something in that as well. The great advantage of a slightly dirty government is that you can get things done. The disadvantage is you may not like the way it looks as it's happening.
It's a benevolent monster situation,
right?
You know.
All right. We're speaking this hour with Brandon Potter, that voice you just heard. He's the actor who plays LBJ, and Kevin Moriarty, artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center and director of its current production of All the Way. That's open at the Dallas Theater Center through April 3rd. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. Find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
The politician's curse, see, is the desperate desire, the absolute need to plan for every contingency, to anticipate every problem, to control everything, even as you know that's impossible. You're not running for office. You're running for your life. You're trying to cheat death.
That is actor Brandon Potter as LBJ in All the Way, which is open at the Dallas Theater Center through April 3rd. Also with us on Think This Afternoon is Kevin Moriarty, artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center, and he directed this production. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Brandon, I hope that you won't mind me pointing this out, but I could have babysat for you. Like, you are much younger, much younger than the man you are portraying. And I know actors do that all the time, but you have to act not only with like your physical mannerisms and your voice, but it seems to me there was a difference in the way you breathed on stage.
Yeah, well, breath is a critical part of performance. I mean, that's, if you look at the word inspiration, right, that's, that deals with breath. I think that in terms of LBJ, I would breathe like it was my last breath ever and to drive through these sort of enormous thoughts that he has. And he does have a lot of really, really big thoughts. Even it's not quite like Shaw where there's, you know, an entire paragraph that's one sentence. But he does have these big, long LBJ-isms, right? And he knows the end of that. So he knows exactly where – I don't know where the pauses are, where all the hitches are, where the most effective punchline is, all of that stuff. I guess what I'm saying is that he's thinking two steps ahead and you have to breathe accordingly. You know, it's not like some other characters and some other author's work or some other playwright's work where it's all immediate and maybe it's just one little thing and then, oh, just another little thing and then just another little thing. It's not that way with LBJ. But, you know, it's exactly where he's going and he's going there right now.
And if Johnson was an accidental president, then Brandon has been an accidental LBJ because – and that explains why, as you've said, he's a bit younger than you might expect or even than he appears on stage. That's because this production is a collaboration between Dallas Theater Center and the Alley Theater in Houston, which is one of the oldest and most respected theaters, not just in the state but in the country. We – each of our theaters have acting companies, resident acting companies. That's relatively unusual. Most theaters don't, but we do still. So we brought in this production half of the Houston acting company together with half of the Dallas acting company. And we produced this play first in Houston and now we've brought it here to Dallas. So we're rehearsing the play and Brandon was in the cast, but he was not playing Lyndon Johnson. He was playing George Wallace. And an older actor in the Alley Company, a very respected, incredibly talented actor, was playing Johnson and was doing phenomenal work in the rehearsal room. It was really stunning. And just, I think, 4 days before we left the rehearsal room to go into the theater, that actor became sick and suddenly withdrew from the production. And we didn't have a Lyndon Johnson. This play is a nearly three-hour play with 17 actors, but Johnson is at the center of this play. He drives the play. He talks all night long. He talks a mile a minute. He tells jokes. He's incredibly theatrical. It's a wild performance. So we suddenly had no lead actor in our play, and we quickly got on the phone and started calling actors who were in their mid to late 50s and early 60s who were powerful, strong actors and said, hey, could you fly to Houston to immediately go on stage in a play that you haven't seen or read before? And can you memorize this entire thing? And all of the actors and their agents said, I'd love to do it, but I need 3 or 4 weeks to prepare. I just can't memorize a three-hour play in a matter of days.
Isn't that like every actor's nightmare dream, that you're thrown on stage in a role you've never seen before?
And this exact nightmare dream is what happened to Brandon. I went to him in the middle of a rehearsal. I put a pause on the rehearsal, sent all the actors on a break, said, Brandon, can you come and talk to me? And I said, Brandon, I'm going to ask you something surprising, and you can think about this, but we would like you to stop playing George Wallace and to step into the role of Lyndon Johnson. And Brandon immediately said yes and jumped in on it. But to put this in context, he was memorizing a three-hour play every night while also memorizing all of the staging and all of the character and all of that. The first time that Brandon performed the entire play from beginning to end from memory was in front of 750 paying audience members at the first performance on stage at the Alley Theater in Houston. So talk about actor's nightmare.
Or actor's dream. That's the greatest adrenaline rush you could possibly get, you know, is going up there thinking, do I know this? Can this happen? Who knows? The lights are up. The show's starting right now.
I would imagine it's liberating in some ways, because if anybody is told that story and you know, you could know in the back of your mind you really, really want it to be perfect. But just getting through it would be a victory. And in some ways, that's got to sort of divorce you from the concerns about each little thing. Does that make sense?
Sure. I mean, that could be a safety, right? But once you're up there and you're doing the show, you do want to respond to what's happening in front of you, and you do want to live truthfully under these imaginary circumstances, and you do want to get what you want from your acting partner. So the tether may theoretically be there, but you're not really thinking about that when the lights come up and 750 people are watching you. You don't really get the sense of safety when that happens.
Kevin, you famously like to make changes up until the very last moment. Was this big enough change for you that you weren't messing with anything else?
I think it's often remarked on by artists who work with me that I tend to constantly inject chaos into a process, that I tend to believe that out of chaos comes the most creative solution. So I often, in the middle of a rehearsal process or a design process or a writing process, throw in a series of new restrictions or seemingly impossible tasks or aesthetic ideas, because fighting up against those things with all the artists doing that often releases new ideas and new ways, and frankly builds just a large amount of creative energy in the space and in the room. You can feel a kind of sense of danger and stakes that happen as an audience member. In this case, yes, it's a complicated show. There's 17 actors. They're playing more than 40 characters. There's constant costume changes and wig changes, and the stage is filled with a lot of technologically sophisticated video effects. And yet throwing a brand new actor into the starring role, that would definitely be the definition of injecting chaos.
There are some magnificent opportunities for salty language here. And at the production that I attended, the nice little ladies sitting next to me were commenting in intermission that they didn't know that the president ever spoke that way. And I was surprised that people didn't know this about LBJ. But it also made me think that, you know, history gets so sanitized, even when we're telling stories of people that we know, you know, played kind of fast and loose with everything.
It does get sanitized. I have a hard time imagining that they didn't know that LBJ spoke that way, because he was so famous for that. I mean, he was famous for being a down-home good old boy, even up in the White House.
Was that an act at all?
The good old boy?
Yeah.
I think well, oh gosh, okay. I don't know about the real LBJ. So the people who knew him said that he was a different person to everyone. So it was impossible to get a bead on him. So I wouldn't presume about the real LBJ. But in terms of the play, I think some of this stuff is, if not an act, a tactic. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That he knows that people respond a certain way to this affable redneck. Right. And
easy to underestimate.
Easy to underestimate is a good way to think about that. It puts people off their guard. It makes people think that they have the upper hand. It can also do things like in the sort of halls of Washington where people are staunch and prim and proper and all of that. It can make someone seem more genuine. Like, oh, you're a nice person doing a nice thing, when that might not be the case with LBJ. But he can definitely make himself seem that way and endear himself to people with it. So if not an act, a strategy.
This is also where I think the historical record, the fact that we have literally the actual audio tapes of all of these recordings is really instructive, because anybody who had written a play in 1963, 64, 65, by necessity would have had to have cleaned up the language. I mean, characters on a Broadway stage did not speak with this colorful a language.
As we
then.
Won't hear this afternoon.
Exactly. It's tempting, but we won't. And that's also true, was true on television and in movies. And yet with – so it's easy to think of history, even history as recently as the 1960s, as being a time when people didn't swear, that there's a coarsening of language in society. But then when you hear – I mean, these are great, great leaders that you're hearing on these recordings, and you hear the language that they're using, the jokes that they're telling, the threats that they're throwing. It makes you realize that the past was not a sepia-toned filter. It was the past wasn't as it was shown in the time on television or in movies or on stage. The past was surprisingly like the present.
Maybe that's a way to think about it is, you know, when you said the past was sanitized, I don't think we're sanitizing it in hindsight. I think it was sanitized as it was presented to the public in the past. Hmm. Do you know what I mean? When people appeared on television and things like that.
I'm sure there are people who would prefer not to be reminded that despite all his astonishing achievements and his great passion for what was right in civil rights, that Dr. King was a serial philanderer whose, you know, actions really hurt the people who loved him. You didn't write the script, but do you feel like, Kevin, it was important that that exist within this script?
It is important for several reasons. One is because in his lifetime and in the direct events that happen in this play with the passage of the Civil Rights Bill, J. Edgar Hoover had evidence of King's extramarital affairs, recorded evidence. He had bugged King's hotel rooms. And he used that evidence to try to block the Civil Rights Bill from being passed. Hoover was working independently of Johnson even while working in the Johnson administration. Hoover was absolutely convinced that King and the civil rights movement was actually a front for communist sympathizers. He was very concerned that either King was being duped by the communists or was an active participant in that belief system. And so he, believing that and unable to get traction on that with Johnson, Hoover told Johnson, I've got proof King is having extramarital affairs. And Johnson said, you know, who doesn't have affairs? You know, that's the way of the world. Don't do anything with this. He was ordered not to release that material. And yet he did. Hoover sent it to the press. And when it was largely the mainstream press refused to publish it, he then attempted to blackmail King. The FBI of the United States, I mean our actual federal government, sent audio tape recordings of King having sexual relations with a woman, not his wife, to his home so that his wife would open that up and hear that. And there was a scrawled handwritten note inside of it, not attributed directly to the FBI, of course, that instructed King to kill himself. It's a ham-fisted move and shocking in our modern sensibilities that the FBI would be spying on private American citizens and then attempting to influence political activities by using that information. But that's the context in which King was attempting to pass this major legislation. And I think for us today, as we think about leaders who have to not only have the courage of their conviction and lead the country forward, but also need to confront the fact that anything they've done in their lives, anything they may not even be personally proud of, is going to be used against them on Twitter or on the internet or in the modern news media. And the courage it takes to withstand that and the techniques it takes to work around that or divert the American people's attention from that is a part of modern political life, and it was a part of political life in 1963.
The action of this play, the facts of this play are mostly about civil rights legislation, strategy, compromise. But, you know, Vietnam, although it's largely on the horizon, there are dark hints of it. And we have this scene where it feels very much like Johnson makes a pretty hasty decision regarding the events taking place in the Gulf of Tonkin. And it's almost like he doesn't even realize the significance of what he does in the moment.
Well, I think that that decision ultimately comes down to him consolidating his power here so that he can continue to do the war on poverty, so that he can continue to do the civil rights bill. The way that I think about the scene is that only if I do this so Goldwater doesn't have any soft on the military fuel to use against me. Only if I do this thing over in the Gulf of Tonkin will I be allowed to continue with my work on civil rights and poverty. So it is not the right decision, but it is, in my mind, the only thing that will allow this legislation to move forward. So I think it's maybe quick, but it isn't he did think about it. He did have to think about it. And of course, that later mars his entire legacy and all of that stuff. But maybe if he hadn't responded the way that he did to the Gulf of Tonkin, maybe Goldwater would have been able to have some sort of ammunition against him. Maybe the American public would have turned against him or something. I don't know. I do know that he was able to get this stuff done, and that seems to be a part of it.
In some ways, I think that Johnson's character is somewhat like Nixon's in that, and perhaps many of our American political leaders this would be true of, in that he had a streak of paranoia. A streak of paranoia about his enemies, and that his enemies might even be people who seemingly were his friends, or certainly his fear of Bobby Kennedy was deep, and though based in reality, veered at times on irrationality. And Johnson was an ardent anti-communist, but also it was very important at that time in America not just to be anti-communist, to be seen as anti-communist. Being soft on communism could stain your record, and in doing that, it could limit your effectiveness. Mm-hmm. In order to stay the strongest leader, the strongest man in the room, in order to stay the toughest guy in the nation and in the world, you needed to project that. And there's a moment in the play, and it's not a moment that is favorable to Johnson, where Hubert Humphrey directly – Robert McNamara and Hubert Humphrey are in the Oval Office, each pushing Johnson in opposite directions about what to do. And Humphrey says, if you do – Mr. President, if you do what McNamara is asking you to do in relation to Vietnam, this will – you will be lying to the American people. And Johnson says, do it.
We're speaking this hour with Kevin Moriarty, Artistic Director of the Dallas Theater Center and Director of the production of All the Way, open there through April 3rd. My other guest is actor Brandon Potter, who portrays Lyndon Baines Johnson in the production. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The Dallas Theater Center's production of the Tony Award-winning play All the Way is open through April 3rd. We're speaking this hour with the actor who plays LBJ, Brandon Potter, and with director Kevin Moriarty. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Johnson famously predicted upon signing the Civil Rights Act into law that the Democratic Party had lost the South for a generation. It turns out he was half right, right? Half right and counting, because it's been two generations already. Did he believe the legislation was more important than the politics? Would he have done it had he recognized that this might limit other things that the party could do?
Yes. There we heard an interesting story from Up to Grove the other night, one of the scholars at the LBJ Museum, and he said that when he was talking to one of his mentors, Richard Russell, he said, "You can bulldoze me if you want, but you will lose the party, you will lose the chance at the presidency." And he said, "If that's what it takes, then that's what I'll do." So I think that he would have done it anyway. I think maybe he could even see it coming.
I think it's fascinating. That not only speaks to the depth of LBJ's character on the issue of civil rights, which in 1963, no one would have predicted that Lyndon Johnson was going to pick up the mantle of civil rights. He did not have a good record, mm-hmm. on a mixed record at best on civil rights throughout his political career. until that moment when he ascended to ultimate power. And faced with the opportunity to be the most powerful man in the country, he decided to use that power for something that that he had had to spend his life as a Southern politician up to then biting his tongue on. He says in the play at one point, I've bitten my tongue on the issue of civil rights until my mouth was filled with blood, and that this is the moment now where I can finally move forward. But what's fascinating to me in a modern context, watching audiences watch the play in 2016, it doesn't feel like history at all, because the events that the play depicts show a political party, in this case the Democratic Party, where the party is held together for so many years by a somewhat unlikely mix of Southern Democrats who cared passionately about maintaining the status quo with race relations, and then a Northeastern group of liberals who are otherwise quite different than those Southerners in their beliefs. And finally, in the 60s, the party comes to that splitting point where no longer can the two halves of the party stay together. Well, we're in the middle of an election season right now on both the right and the left, where both political parties are asking, what is it that binds us together? And especially in the Republican Party right now, there's the genuine real possibility that the choices that are made in this election and the choices that may be made by the next president, if a Republican is elected president, could result in a realignment of the parties, or the split, or even the destruction of the party as we know it. And that's exactly what happened in the 1960s. The Democratic Party stopped being the party of the South. It stopped being that grand old party where Southern Democrats were the norm, where the entire South was controlled by Democrats. And today, the entire South is controlled by Republicans. And it's because of race and civil rights.
Do you find, Brandon, is this the large – I don't know. Have you played a president before in a role of this size?
No. I've never played a president before, and I've never played a role of this size before. But I don't think it would be all that unusual for any actor to say that they've played a role of this size before.
Right. Well,
or presidents. There aren't that many presidents.
Yeah, not that many presidential
I didn't know
plays.
If, you know, in college there had been a play. Anyway, my question is, are there things that you think you get about – the people running for office right now that you understand, having done the work of trying to embody this just purely political human being?
When you're in my line of work, you're always trying to get into other people's heads, and it's difficult to tell sometimes what is a real understanding and what is your weirdo actor understanding that may have no bearing on reality. But there are many things that I feel like I understand about politicians and the political life. And again, maybe I have a real understanding of it, or maybe I have an artist's understanding of it. But the thing that always strikes a chord with me is the nature of compromise, which is what we talked about earlier, that you will never be doing the right thing, that whatever you are doing, it's only mostly right. And you have to sort of do that moral calculus in your head all of the time. And that's something that resonated with me for whatever reason. And it's something that I've started in a very strange way to take into my personal life. Like, how mostly right is this? Or am I only after this because it's 100% right? Am I willing to compromise on this? I'm not sure. You know, I think that personal struggle is magnified when you're a politician. And I can't imagine the pressure it must put on people. Or maybe I can't imagine it. Maybe I'm having fun imagining it. Maybe I'm getting paid to imagine it right now at Dallas Theater Center. I don't know.
Watching the play, it's really striking because you see LBJ's running for office, but of course running against him isn't just Barry Goldwater on the Republican side. He also has a real problem inside his party, Strom Thurmond, and especially George Wallace, who eventually does break away and run independently for president. That establishment versus the regular guy, Johnson versus Wallace, it has so many echoes today. And throughout the rehearsal process, we would be working on a scene with these characters and it would suddenly sound like it had been ripped from the headlines. Yep. That's also true in the play as inside of King's movement when Bob Moses and David Dennis start really saying, we're tired of turning another cheek in the face of violence by authorities, violence by cops against black people. I mean, that's what happened with the Freedom Riders, for instance. And those monologues could absolutely be spoken in the moments following Ferguson. They could be a speech by a Black Lives Matter activist, and yet they're actually 1963, the words of history. That's even more palpable for us here in Dallas today. We're on this production, we're partnering with the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. And we have had lots of opportunities to do public events with historians, and we've had the opportunity we're bringing more than 1,000 high school kids who will see the play before they see the play. They're seeing the play at nighttime with adult audiences, but the buses will take them to the Sixth Floor Museum. They'll spend an hour in a special curated exhibit for them that covers the moment leading up to and the moment of the assassination. And then they'll move, they'll jump back on their buses and go a mile away to the Wiley Theater, where the question becomes, what happened next? What happened out of that tragedy? The play starts with that first moment on Air Force One where Johnson is flying from Dallas back to Washington. And what I think you experience at the museum is not only the details of that horrific day in Dallas, but also the context in which the assassination took place, which was a complicated time in Dallas's history. Certainly the city of Dallas did not in any way kill John F. Kennedy, but the city of Dallas was in the midst of a complicated understanding of race and justice and equality. And going back to that time and experiencing that at the museum or in the history books, and then experiencing the events of this play where this great Texan steps forward and attempts to change that is awe-inspiring and deeply moving.
Did you see the Broadway production?
Yeah, I saw the play when it was initially premiered in Oregon. Then I saw it again on Broadway when Bryan Cranston played the role. And then I had the opportunity a few months ago to go to Seattle and to see the new play, the sequel that Robert Schenken has written called The Great Society. If All the Way is essentially a thrilling, intense, at times dramatic, but ultimately it has a celebratory ending. The Johnson's reelected and civil rights is passed. Oh, spoiler alert. But but in Great Society picks up the story after that. And that play, instead of being a victory, is a play of immense defeat, because what follows in the ensuing years as the Vietnam War becomes more prevalent, as riots take over our streets, and you ultimately get to the point where Johnson himself can't even stand for re-election. He can't even be nominated in his own political party, the Democratic Party that he loved so much. And those two plays together tell a really full and rich part of American history, the triumphs and the defeats.
I wonder what you do with that much familiarity with another director's vision of the script, and whether when I'm going to be interviewing someone, I really don't want to I don't want to do anything that someone else has done, even if it's a great idea. And sometimes it's very limiting. I wonder how you free yourself to take things that worked and also change things simply because you think they ought to be done a different way.
That's just a big part of the job, and it's frankly one of the most fun parts of being a director, is confronting a text and confronting other ways that a story can be told, and then finding your own way into telling that story. So in this case, for instance, the Bill Rausch's production on Broadway was a stunning, stunning production, but was approached more in some ways as documentary theater rather than as a Shakespeare history play. So for instance, when characters spoke on telephones, they stood in an isolated body of light and looked straight out at the audience, almost like they were looking at a camera in a visual documentary. In our production, we thought, oh, well, this is a play of American history the same way Shakespeare wrote history, British history, Henry IV or Henry V. And so we said, well, characters in a history play would actually look at each other. And so our characters, even though they're holding telephones, are able to inhabit the same space as each other. They're able to sit down and walk around and get in each other's faces and actually have a dialogue instead of monologues next to each other. Similarly, we're using a lot of video, historically accurate video from the time period. But instead of showing the video on movie screens, big, large TV screens that realistically would look like how TV would look back then, instead we're taking live actors and putting them in the middle of a space and then projecting the historical video on top of them and around them, fragmented in all different ways. So you have a real live actor but portraying a character who is not them, but surrounded by actual video of the time frame that creates the world in which they live. And that visual interplay of today and fiction and actors in with elements that are completely real, the historical events and the images themselves from history, is a kind of fun way of visualizing the great challenge and joy of doing historical fiction.
How do you approach that as an actor, Brendan? How do you make LBJ LBJ and also make him your LBJ?
What Kevin was saying earlier about this being a documentary process. This is not a documentary process. So you have to look at things in terms of service to the narrative, right? So say, for example, LBJ talks slower than I talk, mm-hmm. right, on stage. If I talked at the pace that LBJ talks at, especially giving public speeches, this would turn into a four-hour play, and we can't let that happen.
No.
So there are practical things like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that can also be informed by reality instead of just the necessity of doing a play, because you can listen to his speeches on the Senate floor or to the cameras, and he has this sort of broken-up drawl, right? But when you listen to the phone calls, he can talk so fast and deliver so many ideas that he can beat down any sort of response from anyone. He can barely give him a chance to respond. You drive a hard bargain. Oh, no, I don't. You know, that kind of stuff. So you can latch onto those little bits of truth, right? His sort of quiet jackhammer style of conversation. And you can apply that and you can inject that into the other parts of the play. So what it really becomes is taking nuggets of truth from the real LBJ and injecting that into the narrative and fictional and artistic license bits of the play, so that it becomes overall about capturing energy and spirit instead of doing every little thing. You know, someone asked me the other day why, you know, he was famous for, like, you know, picking his nose and digging in his crotch and all of that stuff. Do you do any of that? And I said, only when the text supports it, because if you do that stuff when there's no text behind it, then the cake suddenly becomes about the icing instead of the cake.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? It just isn't supported by the words. So people are like, oh my gosh, he's doing some vulgar thing. And what they're missing out on is an incredible power struggle between the different factions of the Democratic Party. And I would not like for me picking my nose to upstage this critical bit of American history.
Wise choice.
Yeah.
Yes.
Actor Brendan Potter plays LBJ in the production All the Way at the Dallas Theater Center, which is open through April 3rd. Kevin Moriarty directed that production, and he's artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center. It's been great to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank
Chris.
You.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. We had help on the phones today from Alex Smith. The show's email address is think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink, and I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.